Readers, welcome back to the Book Report. I'm your host, Elaine Charles, and if you've been tuning in recently, you know we've been traveling around the world to see what readers in far-flung countries are reading, as well as sharing samples from their national authors. Today, we're headed for the Far East, and we're about to stamp some very different titles onto our literary passport. In addition, we've got a special guest I know you'll find intriguing. Let's get started.
Traditional advertising can be expensive and wasteful. But lately, you've been hearing a lot about social media and viral marketing. But let's be honest, it's confusing. That's why you need Magic Buzz, a new marketing company so unique, we've even coined a special phrase for what we do. Socio-viral. We combine the word-of-mouth friendliness of social media, like Facebook, Twitter, together with the viral reach power of YouTube, to create the socio-viral effect. The Magic Buzz team makes sure our clients are well represented online. We recently took word-of-mouth advertising to the number one position as most productive medium for a major cell phone company. That's right. Magic Buzz produced more sales than an expensive TV campaign at a fraction of the cost. Put the power of socio-viral marketing to work for you. Visit us at magicbuzz.com. M-A-G-I-C-B-U-Z.com. If you have any questions, please feel free to email us at info@magicbuzz.com. Magic Buzz, we're there when you can't be.
Lisa Napoli is a journalist who has worked around the world and around the media landscape. She began her career in the early 80s at CNN in Atlanta. She worked in local TV news in North Carolina, covered the Clinton campaign and Waco standoff as a field producer for Fox News. She covered the early days of the web for the New York Times and served as an internet correspondent for MSNBC. Most recently, she served as a reporter backup host for the public radio show Marketplace in L.A. She had never traveled to Asia before she was asked, by chance, to go to Bhutan in 2006. Welcome, Lisa.
Welcome to you. Thank you for having me.
I want to know, I'm enjoying your book so much. What was happening in your life that gave you the impetus and the courage to travel solo across the world to a remote place like Bhutan?
Well, you know what happens when you sort of reach the bottom and you kind of, doesn't matter what presents itself, you'll just sort of take the lifeline out. That's sort of where I was. I was really worried about being in my 40s. I didn't see a future for myself in my profession, in my personal life. I just didn't know what was next. And then I just met this cute guy at a party who presented this opportunity to me to go to this exotic place. And I didn't even think about whether it was scary or practical. I just sort of went because I was just so excited to have a way out of what my day-to-day was like at the time.
So for readers who don't yet know, where exactly is Bhutan and how the heck do you get there?
That's good. Okay, so Bhutan is in the Himalayas. It's surrounded by Nepal and India and Tibet. So it's in a very populous part of the world, but it's a very tiny country. It's about the size of Switzerland. And to get there, you have to go basically either to Delhi, New Delhi, or Bangkok. And then you take a local airline. The only airline that flies into Bhutan is their national airline for another four-hour trip or so. And then you have to drive for a couple of hours, or at least you did back then, to the capital city, which is where I was staying the first time I went.
So would you encourage intrepid travelers to visit there today?
Well, you know, it's a wonderful place to visit as a tourist. And if you are an experienced tourist and a tolerant tourist and an adventurous one, it's a fantastic place to go. It costs a lot of money to go there. I didn't pay this because I was volunteering, but if you go there as a tourist, you have to pay, it's up to $250 a day per person,
wow,
minimum. So it's not cheap. And it's not easy to get there if you're coming from the United States. But if you want to see something that's unspoiled, unlike anywhere you've ever been before, Bhutan is it. It's a Buddhist country. And so it's steeped in Buddhist tradition, very colorful, bright, just just a magnificent place.
Okay, in the book, you mentioned that in 1999, the king, and I'll try not to mispronounce his name, correct me, Jigme Singye Wangchuck.
You got it.
Oh, good.
Excellent.
Okay, after years of self-imposed isolation, he decided to allow TV and the internet into the country. What was his impetus for doing so at that time?
Well, it's not really clear because he's never said for sure. I mean, you can read the speech that he gave, but that doesn't even really spell it out. But what people surmise is that he saw that the world was, he had allowed tourists in the 70s. Tourists didn't even come to Bhutan until the 70s. So as this steady drip of tourism was coming in, and as he was allowing more people to go out to study, he saw that he couldn't cordon off the world, himself from the world any longer. And he hoped that the people, he says in his speech where he announced that these things would be available, would tread the middle path, which is a very Buddhist philosophy, you know, no extremes, just sort of trusting yourself to follow the middle path and just be deliberate and measured about how you use television. What he didn't factor in was how much people would love television and fall in love with the consumer culture and just the outside world. Hmm. So it's not really entirely clear why he did it, but I think he saw the writing was on the wall. And certainly if you look at other countries right now that are going through so much turmoil, where they've tried to restrict access to these kinds of modern tools, it creates problems. So he probably just trusted people to, you know, understand it.
All right. So you worked, volunteered at Radio Kuzu, Kuzu. Now, what does that mean? Does it mean that Kuzu means something in Bhutan?
Yes. Kuzu is short for Kuzu Zampo La, which is hello in Dzongkha. So think about it as hello FM.
Oh, all right. And is Dzongkha the language that they speak and not called Bhutanese? Or
it's not called Bhutanese. Dzongkha is the native tongue, and that's the name of the language, which is apparently derivative of Tibetan. Dzongkha is a dzong is the fortress that is built in each district. These majestic, magnificent fortresses are built in each district in Bhutan. And so Dzongkha is language of the dzongs.
All right. So you've been traveling there. You've been there 6 times now over the last 4 years.
Yes.
What changes have you seen, and are they for the better, or what's your view on that?
Well, it would be my opinion to say that it's not necessarily for the better. But of course, I didn't grow up in a country that didn't have roads or hard currency or electricity until the 70s. So it's easy for me to say that it's scary when I go back there now and see twice as many cars as there ever used to be. Literally, there are up to 40,000 cars in the country, whereas there were only half that 5 years ago. You know, it's easy for me to say that I don't like to see these sophisticated commercials coming on television because they signify that people are more interested in consumer culture. Well, it's easy for me to say I don't like consumer culture because I grew up here in the United States with it, but I can see how if I hadn't grown up with it, I would be very enamored of the idea of being able to buy things and, you know, make my home look prettier. But it's a strange transition to see Bhutan become more sophisticated. There are more banks than ever before. There are coffee shops where there weren't coffee shops before. And yeah, coffee shops are great. That means maybe you'll go sit with your friends and drink some coffee, right? But if you think about the underlying fundamentals of that, that means that you're not necessarily gathering at home anymore if you're going out for coffee. And why are you not gathering at home? Well, because home is becoming less of a place that it used to be in Bhutan, which was sort of the focal point for everyone, for multi-generations. You know, if you and I were sisters, we lived together, we'd live with our husbands, our kids, our extended families would all be under one roof. And if your friend came by to see you, she was probably my friend too, and we would hang out if you weren't around. So that kind of nice pace of culture that existed in Bhutan is being replaced by the busyness factor that we have here that isolates so many of us, even in the busiest of cities. It's a tough change to see.
I wanted to ask you, what's the population of Bhutan?
Sorry, yeah. The population in this country the size of Switzerland is about 650,000 people. So it's not populous at all. But the capital city where I've spent most of my time while I've been in Bhutan is growing rapidly. It's now up to about 100,000 people from 15 years ago, it had about 15 or 20,000 people in it. So it's explosive growth. And it's, you know, all the attendant changes that come when the city grows so quickly.
So in each of your visits there, about how long was each visit?
Anywhere from 2 weeks to 2.5 months. So each visit was very different. The first time I went was for 6 weeks. And the basis of my book is on the first two or three visits that I made there. But so I've spent varying degrees of time there. And I've spent a lot of time with Bhutanese people here in the U.S. And I also, I've really immersed myself in Bhutanese history. Not that, you know, anybody can ever accurately write another place's history well, especially a place as mysterious as this, but it's been a real pleasure for me to immerse myself in the very limited number of resources there are about Bhutan's history over the last 4 years.
Can you share one or two favorite memories of your first or second visit there?
Oh, wow. Well, you know, my favorite memory opens the book that I wrote is when I visited this place called Tiger's Nest, which is a very sacred monastery in Bhutan. It's said to be the place where Buddhism was brought to Bhutan in the 16th century. And I'm sorry, in the 8th century. And I walked up to Topsang, Tiger's Nest, this magnificent monastery, with a group of people from the radio station and a couple of other expats who were also there volunteering for different, one was a nurse and one was a golf pro, oddly enough. And we all walked up as a group to this magnificent place. And, you know, it was a magical day. It was a beautiful, crisp, cold day. But what was so memorable about it was that all of us were so different. You know, we ranged in age from 20 to 60, and we all had very different backgrounds, but we were all together united on this trek, and we really kind of put in perspective anything I felt about where I was in my life, the sorrow I felt about not having certain things, the loss I felt in my life from love, and just this feeling of not uncertainty about what I was going to do with the rest of my life just melted away while I was walking up to this monastery. And that was a memory that sticks with me today, even. It was just such a humbling and wonderful experience to see this place through the eyes of these locals and these other older expats, and all of us together united was a really beautiful memory.
Oh, tell us about your philanthropic project for Bhutan.
Oh, thank you for asking about that. So I've been, ever since I've been going to Bhutan, I've been looking for ways to give back. And a lot of the visitors who go to Bhutan are very wealthy, so they can, you know, build kitchens on the sides of monasteries when they need them, or sponsor kids to go to private school here in the U.S. And my means are not quite that grand. So I've sent a couple of kids to school in Bhutan, and then I found, and that was interesting, but there isn't a real mechanism for giving that way. So what I've been doing is working with this new nonprofit to Bhutan called Read Global, and it's an initiative of the Bill Gates Foundation. And I'm working with some friends to raise $50,000 to build a library in the eastern part of Bhutan. There aren't very many libraries there. So it's very exciting that this organization has come in and is starting to build them in places where kids are just hungry for knowledge and a community gathering place, but have never had them before. So Read Global is the organization that I'm working to help support. I don't want to start a nonprofit. I don't have the mechanism to do that, but I can certainly help funnel awareness to people who are interested in that by sending them to bookstobhutan.com.
All right. Well, Leith, I really enjoyed your book. I stayed up late reading it. It's such an easy but, you know, meaningful read. Thanks very much, and thanks for being a guest today.
Thank you so much for having me. I really appreciate it.
All right. Bye now.
Bye.
Wow. one part travel guide and one part exploration of a life-changing journey, Lisa Napoli's book, Radio Shangri-La, is about the author's love affair with the remote kingdom of Bhutan. No, this is not a run-of-the-mill retelling of a midlife crisis. And yes, fans of Eat, Pray, Love will find lots to love. But this delightful read or listen is so much more. Lisa undertook the journey to Bhutan when a new friend offered to hook her up as a volunteer with a new radio station there. Bhutan is a country long been cut off from the rest of the world and has only recently allowed its citizens access to TV and the web. In many ways, the country is a window into the past, but it is also a country with a very unique culture. Phalluses are drawn on the side of buildings to discourage evil spirits. The government measures GNH, that's gross national happiness, instead of monetary wealth. And there's a $200 per day tourist tax that continues to keep most of the world out. Radio Shangri-La is an account of two starkly different lifestyles and places. The first is Napoli's fast-paced life in L.A., and the second is her Bhutanese life, which is slower, simpler, and oftentimes more rewarding. What's most delightful about Napoli's experience are the human interactions she has and the friends she makes through her numerous trips to the country. Stark cultural differences abound, but deep connection is a major theme. The Bhutanese welcome her. They are eager to learn from her and show off their country. They also give her insight into what is true happiness. The author narrates.
If you travel here on a day the calendar is deemed to be auspicious, the merit you accumulate will be even more abundant. Nawang tells us the first time she remembers visiting was 2 decades ago when she was 4 years old. Her mother had died, and the monk sent her here to pray. What Taksong promises all who visit is cleansing and renewal. Into this valley in the 8th century, a sage named Guru Rinpoche rode in on the back of a tigress. Then he retreated to a cave for 3 months and, with the most powerful weapon there is, his mind, swashbuckled away evil spirits. In so doing, he persuaded the Bhutanese to adopt Buddhism as their guiding light. Hundreds of years later, to mark the feat, a colony of structures was built in this precarious location, testament to how the people of Bhutan have long revered him, this being they considered the second Buddha. As we climb higher and higher, and as the gold-topped Taksong comes into view, I can feel Guru Rinpoche's strength bolstering my own, diminishing demons, softening my heart. This is the story of my midlife crisis and how I wrestled with and then transcended it, thanks to a chance encounter that led me to a mysterious kingdom in Asia few have visited. In the march of years leading up to my 40th birthday and on the rapid ascent into that menacing decade, I'd found myself Monday morning quarterbacking every step of my life, haunted by the revisionist history of regret. A near continuous looping chorus of what-ifs and if-onlys became my soundtrack. Why had I failed to have a family with the man I loved? Why had I squandered my youth so haphazardly? Why had I stuck with the profession that infuriated me so intensely? What could I do with the second half of my life to make it more meaningful than the first? How was I going to grow old gracefully? Inhaling the cold, clear air on that trek up to Taksong on the other side of the world from home, the pain and noise of those questions began, finally, to melt away, to morph into a sense of acceptance and peace. No longer did I feel stuck on a treadmill of emptiness. Now my life story read as full, exciting, wondrous, with limitless possibilities for the future. And we hadn't even reached the most sacred spot on the mountain. The groundwork for this awakening had been laid months earlier, when I had only the vaguest of ideas where this place called Bhutan was on the planet. Every Wednesday evening, I headed west on the clogged I-10 freeway in Los Angeles for an experimental workshop in positive psychology. In classic therapy, where you endlessly review all your personal history, you work to gain a better understanding of why you are the way you are and have done what you've done. But it isn't necessarily designed to help you move forward, much less reframe the way you look at the world. By now, with the help of various counselors, I'd navel-gazed a giant gaping hole in my belly button, dissecting my own personal history the way a Proust scholar did remembrance of things past. And yet, I still found myself swirling in a vortex of despair. I summoned a sense of optimism about this happiness class and hoped that it might at least be a salve, if not a cure, for how poorly I'd been handling the approach into middle age. It seemed unlikely, though, that a 6-week class could possibly jolt me into contentment or anything approximating happiness. Since the workshop wasn't yet fully developed, the teacher, Johnny, asked for our patience. We'd been acting as guinea pigs for this program, he said, and there wouldn't be any charge. A romp into positive thinking? Gratis? I couldn't resist.
On the evening of March 17, 1959, as the people of Tibet braced for a violent power grab by Chinese occupiers, the 24-year-old Dalai Lama, Tibet's political and spiritual leader, contemplated the impossible. As Stephen Talty chronicles in Escape from the Land of Snows, the young Dalai Lama's harrowing flight to freedom and the making of a spiritual hero, the task before him was immense. To slip past a cordon of crack Chinese troops ringing his summer palace and, with an escort of 300, journey across the highest terrain in the world and over treacherous Himalayan passes to freedom, one step ahead of the pursuing Chinese soldiers. Mao Zedong had pinned his hopes for total Tibetan submission on controlling the impressionable Dalai Lama. So beloved was this young ruler, so identified with his country's essence, that for him to escape might mean perpetual resistance from a population unwilling to tolerate an increasingly brutal occupation. The Dalai Lama's minder sent word to the Tibetan rebels and CIA-trained guerrillas who waited on the route. His Holiness must escape at all costs. In many ways, the 14th Dalai Lama was unprepared for this epic journey. If you admire the Dalai Lama, follow his work, or have seen him speak, as I have been fortunate to do, you will find this book riveting. It's narrated by Shishir Kurup.
The Dalai Lama had been receiving messengers arriving from Lhasa and beyond with stories of Chinese atrocities against his people. Beheadings, disembowelments, accounts of monasteries burned with monks inside them. That were so outlandishly brutal that he had to admit he himself didn't believe them all. "They were almost beyond the capacity of my imagination," the Dalai Lama remembered. "It simply wasn't possible for human beings to treat one another that way." Now, new reports were coming in daily through the gates of the Norbilinka, watched not only by his bodyguards and Tibetan army troops, but also by representatives of the People's Committee, a bewildering concept in Tibet, which had been ruled for centuries by aristocrats and abbots under the authority of the Dalai Lama himself. These bulletins told him that the Chinese were bringing artillery and reinforcements into Lhasa and installing snipers on the rooftops of his restive city. He could sometimes feel the rumble of tanks' diesel engines as the vehicles negotiated the narrow streets. What he was trying to avoid thinking of as he walked was the dream he'd had last year. He'd seen massacres in his mind, Tibetan men, women, and children being shot and killed by Chinese troops, and his lovely Norbilinka turned into a killing ground. This he kept to himself. But some of his subjects would later report they had had the same dream at the very same time. He knew that such scenes, if they were allowed to unfold in Lhasa, would be the prelude to something much larger. "I feared a massive, violent reprisal which could end up destroying the whole nation," the Dalai Lama said. Lhasa, whose name means place of the gods, had first appeared to him as a city of wonders. Almost 20 years before, he'd entered the capital on a golden palanquin constructed of a curtained box set on poles, carried by teams of young men with massive crowds cheering his approach and bowing to him with the ceremonial katas, or white scarves, in their hands. "There was an unforgettable scent of wildflowers," recalled the Dalai Lama. "I could hear the people crying, 'The day of our happiness has come!'" But it hadn't. In fact, during his reign, disaster had followed disaster. Men in the east of the country were now being driven into barbarism, forced to fight the Chinese and dying in the battles, ensuring themselves a rebirth as lower animals and demons. And Lhasa, too, was growing unstable. The sun was climbing over the small mountains to the east. Soon, he would have to return to the palace. Perhaps what was most shocking about what had happened in the past few days was that the idea of escape wasn't entirely repugnant to him. It would be devastating to his people, for whom he was Kundun, the presence, the spirit of Tibet itself. It would be equally devastating for the nation, for the idea of an independent Tibet, and it cut at his heart to contemplate what it would mean for the future. But it wouldn't necessarily be devastating to him.
The murder of a young Tibetan nun at the hands of Chinese border guards at the rooftop of the world offers a unique parable for the tale of modern Tibet. Murder in the High Himalaya, loyalty, tragedy, and escape from Tibet is a compelling read. Chinese police are instructed to take any measures necessary to protect the border of Tibet. When a group of climbers witnessed the murder of a young Tibetan nun who had been attempting to flee to India, the two men have a choice: turn a blind eye and preserve their climbing careers, or alert the world to the grand scale of human injustice played out in Tibet. Intrepid journalist Jonathan Green investigates this clash of cultures. As he gains entrance to the fascinating network of Tibetan guides and safe houses operating in the name of freedom, he explores the tradition of extreme mountaineering in Chinese-occupied Tibet and establishes contact with surviving refugees. Green offers a rare, affecting portrait of modern Tibet. William Hughes narrates the book.
Hundreds of Tibetan monks, nuns, and lay people are serving prison terms for flying Tibetan flags, for daring to voice their desire for a free Tibet in public, or for supporting the Dalai Lama publicly or privately. In modern-day Tibet, free speech is criminalized. Tibetans can be handed prison terms of 15 years or more by Chinese Communist Party officials for broadcasting their views on websites or speaking out to foreigners about their country on the telephone or in email. Just downloading songs about the Dalai Lama on the internet can result in a jail term. Despite exploding economic and military growth in China, the Communist Party fears separatism and revolt in Tibet, which forms one quarter of China's landmass, as it attempts to consolidate control and assimilate the country into China. Today, Tibetan cities are being flooded with Han Chinese migrants who are rapidly outnumbering Tibetans, leaving them undereducated with ever-dwindling long-term opportunities. Lhasa, once the Forbidden City, is now fast becoming a booming Chinese capital city replete with karaoke bars, brothels, five-star hotels, and luxury car dealerships. The Chinese call Tibet Xizang, meaning Western Treasure House. The exploitation of the natural resources of Tibet is underway. Within the plateau lie 40 million tons of copper, 40 million tons of lead and zinc, and more than a billion tons of iron. Tibetan copper alone amounts to one-third of China's reserves. Mining revenue from Tibet will top $1.5 billion in the coming years. The once indomitable peaks of the Himalaya, which have long served to isolate Tibet from its neighbors, have meanwhile become the ultimate test for serious Western mountain climbers. Each year, increasing numbers seek glory and an escape from the drudgery of their lives, an answer to life's eternal riddle in the world's highest mountain range. Roughly 2,500 Tibetans flee their country annually in a brutal journey over the Himalaya. Some are escaping for a new life in India. All want to meet their exiled spiritual leader, the Dalai Lama. A note on geography. Tibet traditionally comprised three main regions: Amdo, northeastern Tibet, Kham, eastern Tibet, and Utsang, central and western Tibet. In 1965, the Chinese government established the Tibetan Autonomous Region, TAR. It includes Tibet west of the Yangtze River and part of Kham. The rest of Amdo and Kham were incorporated into Chinese provinces. These areas, where there is a dense Tibetan population, are designated as Tibetan Autonomous Prefectures, and Tibetan autonomous counties. Chinese authorities still regard most of Qinghai and parts of Gansu, Sichuan, and Yunnan provinces as Tibetan. Chapter 1. Songs to the Precious One. This core of the earth, this heart of the world, fenced round by snow, the headland of all rivers, where the mountains are high and the land is pure, a country so good, where men are born as sages and heroes, and act according to good laws, a land of horses even more speedy. From a 9th-century document describing Tibet.
An enthralling story that journeys into the land of Kipling and Conrad, The Piano Tuner by Daniel Mason transports you to another world. In October 1886, Edgar Drake receives a strange request from the British War Office. He must leave his wife and his quiet life in London to travel to the jungles of Burma, where a rare grand piano is in need of repair. The piano belongs to an army surgeon, a major whose unorthodox peacekeeping methods, poetry, music, and evenings with local warring princes have brought a tentative quiet to the southern Shan states, but these have elicited questions from his superiors about his loyalty. On his journey through Burma, across Europe, the Red Sea, and India, Edgar encounters prophets and thieves, soldiers and tailspinners, and an enchanting woman as elusive as the surgeon major will turn out to be. On Burma's vast rivers and in her abandoned cities, Edgar encounters a place more mysterious and dangerous than he could have ever imagined. The audiobook is narrated by Richard Matthews.
Despite our military victories, several developments seriously endanger our Burmese possessions. Recent intelligence reports have confirmed the consolidation of French forces along the Mekong River in Indochina, while within Burma, local insurgents threatens our hold on the remoter regions of the colony. In 1869, during the reign of the Burmese King Mindon Min, we stationed in Burma a physician named Surgeon Major Anthony Carroll, a graduate of University College Hospital in London, who in 1874 was appointed to a remote post in the Shan State in the eastern reaches of the colony. Since his arrival, Surgeon Major Carroll has been indispensable to the army, well beyond his immediate medical duties. He has made remarkable progress in forming alliances with native princes and, although distant from our command, his site provides critical access to the southern Shan Plateau and rapid deployment of troops to the Siamese border. The details of Carroll's success are rather unusual, and you will be duly briefed when you report to the War Office. Of concern to the Crown now is a most peculiar request received from the Surgeon Major last month, the latest in a series of somewhat vexing communications regarding his interest in a grand piano. The source of our concern follows. Although we are accustomed to receiving unusual requests from the Surgeon Major with regard to his medical investigations, we were perplexed by a letter that arrived last December requesting the immediate purchase and delivery of one Erard grand piano. At first, the commander in Mandalay was sceptical of the inquiry, until a second message arrived by courier 2 days later, insisting on the seriousness of the demand, as if Carroll had correctly anticipated the incredulity of our staff. Our reply that the delivery of a grand piano was impossible, as there was not one in Burma, was answered by the arrival of yet another breathless messenger 1 week later. He brought a simple note whose contents merit reprinting in full. "Gentlemen, with all due respect to your office, I hereby resubmit my request for an Erard grand piano. I know the importance of my post to the security of this region. Lest the urgency of my request be again misunderstood, be assured that I will resign my post if the piano is not delivered to me within 3 months. I am well aware that my rank and years of service entitle me to honourable discharge and full benefits should I return to England." Surgeon Major Anthony J. Carroll, Mai Luin, Shan States. As you might imagine, this letter precipitated serious consternation among our staff. The Surgeon Major had been a flawless servant of the Crown. His record was exemplary. Yet he understood well our dependence on him and his alliances with the local princes, as well as how critical such alliances are for any European power. After some debate, we approved his request, and an 1840 Erard grand piano was shipped from England in January, arriving in Mandalay in early February, and transported to the site by elephant and foot by Carroll himself. Although the entire escapade was the source of certain frustration for some of our staff in Burma, nevertheless it was a successful mission. In the following months, Carroll continued his fine service, making excellent progress in surveying supply routes through the Shan Plateau. Then last month we received another request. The humidity, it appears, has stretched the body of the Erard such that it is no longer in tune, and all local attempts to mend the instrument have failed. And thus we arrive at the intent of this correspondence. In his letter, Carroll specifically requested a tuner who specialises in Erard grands. While we replied that perhaps there were some easier means by which the piano could be repaired, the Surgeon Major remained adamant in his demand. At last we agreed, and a survey of London piano tuners has produced a list of several fine craftsmen. As you must know, most of the practitioners of your craft are quite advanced in age and not fit for adventure. A more detailed inquiry led us to the names of yourself and Mr. Claude Hastings of Poultry in the city. As you are listed as an expert in Erard pianos, we felt it appropriate to solicit your service. Should you refuse our request, we will proceed to contact Mr. Hastings. The Crown is prepared to reimburse you with a fee equivalent to 1 year of work for service of 3 months. Mr. Drake, your skills and experience commend you to this mission of extreme importance. We graciously request that you contact our office as soon as possible to discuss this matter. Respectfully yours, Colonel L. George Fitzgerald, Assistant Director of Military Operations, Burma and East India Division War Office.
An internationally best-selling author, An Shi Min draws upon her Chinese heritage to pen lush historical epics. In Pearl of China, she transports you to the Far East for a fictionalized account of acclaimed author's Pearl Buck's youth. Arriving in the 19th century China with her missionary parents, Buck is soon fascinated by her new home and strikes up a friendship with a young Chinese girl named Willow. The two become inseparable, even as civil war, failed relationships, and world conflicts threaten all they hold dear. Min's fresh and penetrating interpretation of Pearl S. Buck's extraordinary life delivers profound psychological, spiritual, and historical insights within this unforgettable cross-cultural story. Angela Lin narrates.
Her slanting eyes glowed as she scanned the temples. Nai Nai appeared, disappeared, and reappeared like a ghost. But one night, she stopped. In fact, she collapsed. I was aware that she had been ill. Tufts of her hair had been falling from her head. There was a rotten smell to her breath.
"Go and look for your father," she ordered. "Tell him that my end is near."
Papa was a handsome man in his 30s. He had what a fortune teller would describe as the look of an ancient king, or the matching energy of sky and earth, meaning he had a square forehead and a broad chin. He had a pair of sheep eyes, a garlic-shaped nose that sat on his face like a gentle hill, and a mouth that was always ready to smile. His hair was thick and silky black. Every morning, he combed and braided it with water to make his queue smooth and shining. He walked with his back straight and head up. Speaking Mandarin with an imperial accent, Papa wore his voice like a costume. But when Papa lost his temper, his voice would slip. People were shocked when Mr. Yi suddenly took up a strange voice. Ignoring Nai Nai's opinion that his ambitions would never be realized, Papa dreamed that one day he would work for the governor as an advisor. Papa attended tea houses where he showed off his talent in classic Chinese poems and verse.
"I must keep my mind sharp and literary skills tuned," he often said to me.
One would never guess from the way he presented himself that Papa was a seasonal coolie.
We lived in Zhenjiang, a small town far away from the capital, Peking,
on the south side of the Yangtze River in Jiangsu Province. Originally, our family was from Anhui Province, a harsh region where survival depended on an endless round of crushing physical labor. For generations, my family worked the region's thin and unfertile soil and struggled with famine, flood, locusts, bandits, and debt seekers. Nai Nai bragged that it was she who brought luck to the Yi family. She was purchased by my grandfather when he was 40 years old. No one was allowed to mention that the purchase took place in a local sing-song house. When Nai Nai was in her prime, she had a slender figure, a swan-like neck, and a pair of fox eyes with both ends tilted up. She painted her face every day and modeled her hairstyle after the imperial empress. It was said that men's blood would boil when Nai Nai smiled. By the time the family crossed the Yangtze River and migrated to the south, Nai Nai had given the Yi family three sons. Papa was the eldest, and the only one sent to school. Grandfather expected a return from his investment. Papa was expected to become an accountant so that the family could fight the government's tax collectors. But things didn't turn out right. Grandfather lost his son to the education. Papa believed that he was too good to work as a coolie. At 16, he developed the expensive habits and fantasies of the rich. He read books of China's political reform and chewed tea leaves to sweeten his peasant garlic breath. An ideal life, he told others, would be to compose poems under blossoming plum trees, far away from the greedy material world. Instead of returning home, Papa traveled the country, making his parents pay the bills. One day he received a message from his mother. The message informed him that his father and brothers were gravely ill and near death from an infectious disease that had swept through his hometown. Papa rushed home, but the funeral was already over. Soon enough, his house was possessed by the debt seekers. Nai Nai and Papa fell into poverty and became coolies. Although Nai Nai vowed to regain their former prosperity, she was no longer healthy. By the time I was born, Nai Nai suffered from an incurable intestinal disease.
The Mongol queens of the 13th century ruled one of the largest empires the world has ever known, yet surprisingly little is known about them, until now. Jack Weatherford recounts their tale in The Secret History of the Mongol Queens, how the daughters of Genghis Khan rescued his empire. The queens of the Silk Route turned their father's conquests into the world's first truly international empire, fostering trade, education, and religion throughout the territories. They created an economic system that stretched from the Pacific to the Mediterranean. Outlandish stories of these powerful queens trickled out of the empire, and these shocked Europe and the Islamic world. After Genghis Khan's death in 1227, conflicts erupted between his daughters and daughters-in-law. What began as a war between powerful women soon would become a war against women in power, as brother turned against sister and son against mother. At the end of this epic struggle, it looked as if the dynasty of the Mongol queens would be extinguished forever. But an important warrior queen arose to avenge the wrongs and rescue the tattered shreds of the Mongol Empire. Queen Manduhai led her soldiers through victory after victory. In her 30s, she married a 17-year-old prince and bore 8 children in the midst of a career spent fighting the Ming Dynasty of China on one side and Muslim warlords on the other. Her unprecedented success on the battlefield provoked the Chinese into the most frantic and expensive phase of wall building in history. Charging into battle even when pregnant, she fought to reassemble the Mongol nation of Genghis Khan and to preserve it for her own children to rule in peace. Robertson Dean narrates.
Both the secrecy of the records and the apparent chaos in which they were kept served the purposes of the rulers. With such an unorganized history, the person who controlled the treasury of documents could pick and choose among the papers and hide or release parts as served some political agenda of the moment. If a leader needed to discredit a rival or find an excuse to punish someone, there was always some piece of incriminating evidence that could be pulled from the treasury. Following the example of Genghis Khan, the early Mongol rulers clearly recognized that knowledge constituted their most potent weapon, and controlling the flow of information served as their organizing principle. Genghis Khan sired 4 self-indulgent sons, who proved good at drinking, mediocre in fighting, and poor at everything else. Yet their names live on, despite the damage they did to their father's empire. Although Genghis Khan recognized the superior leadership abilities of his daughters and left them strategically important parts of his empire, today we cannot even be certain how many daughters he had. In their lifetime, they could not be ignored. But when they left the scene, history closed the door behind them and let the dust of centuries cover their tracks. Those Mongol queens were too unusual, too difficult to understand or explain. It seemed more convenient just to erase them. Around the world, the influential dynasties of history exhibit a certain uniformity in their quest for power, and they distinguish themselves from one another primarily through personal foibles, dietary preferences, sexual proclivities, spiritual callings, and other strange twists of character. But none followed a destiny quite like that of the female heirs of Genghis Khan. As in every dynasty, some rank as heroes, others as villains, and most as some combination of the two. Rashid al-Din wrote that, "There are many stories about these daughters. Yet those stories disappeared. We may never find definitive accounts for all 7 or 8 of Genghis Khan's daughters, but we can reassemble the stories of most of them. Through the generations, his female heirs sometimes ruled, and sometimes they contested the rule of their brothers and male cousins. Never before or since have women exercised so much power over so many people and ruled so much territory for as long as these women did." References to Genghis Khan's daughters have come down to us in a jumble of names and titles with a stupefying array of spellings, according to how each sounded to the Chinese, Persians, Armenians, Russians, Turks, or Italians who wrote their stories. Each source differs on the number of daughters. The secret history identifies 8 sons-in-law for Genghis Khan and his wife Berta in the pivotal year 1206, and it further identifies each of them as a commander of 1,000 troops. The list of sons-in-law is longer than the list of daughters, due in part to multiple marriages, and also to the efforts of more distant relatives by marriage to raise their status and apparent closeness to Genghis Khan in the official record. Through the generations, Mongol chroniclers and scholars dropped the names of Genghis Khan's daughters one by one from their accounts. By the time of the Buddhist chroniclers of the 17th century, the number of remembered daughters had dwindled to only 1, and then even she disappeared in the contorted chronicles that followed.
In modern-day Beijing, Mei Wang is a unique entity, the first successful female private detective. Now in Paper Butterfly by Diane Wei Liang, this detective faces her toughest challenge yet. When beloved Chinese pop star Kai Li disappears, Mei Wang must unravel a mystery filled with family secrets and the shadowy truth behind China's labor camps. To make matters more challenging, Kai Li's record company wants her disappearance kept quiet. Following her trail of clues, Wang takes listeners on a sensual tour of China's magnificent capital city. The book is read by Emily Wu Zeller.
"He wasn't a cripple when he came in. The brutes in number 2 made a mess of him. Guard's idea, I heard." Little soldier chewed his nails. "College kid, do nothing, or you'll get yourself killed. Let it go, you can't change anything." Dinner came on aluminum plates, the same every day. Wato, hard corn bun. 34-24, you didn't complete your quota today. Half rations for you." A single wato, the size of Lin's fist, lay on his plate. They squatted to eat. "You must reach your quota, Lin," little soldier swallowed. "Your hands are like a girl's, but not for long working in the lime kiln." He showed Lin his hands, which were dark brown and calloused. These are workers' hands. I do my quota and lie low. 2 more years and I'll go home to my mama. No more bootlegging. I'll find a woman and be happy. Does your mother know where you are? She may. They caught us in Inner Mongolia with our mules. My brother was our leader. They put a bullet in the back of his head. Mama had to pay for the bullet, she said. I haven't seen her since they pushed me onto a truck to come here. They didn't tell me where I was going. Have you had letters from her? She can't write. A man in our village writes letters for everyone, but not from my mama. I've not heard from Grandpa either. He can't know where I am, or he'd write. I don't think anyone knows where I am. The water was hard to chew and even harder to swallow. He'll be waiting for you. My mama's waiting for me, I know. Little soldier thumped his chest. Maybe he's dead. He was 72 when I was arrested. I think of him every day. I wish I could just send a few lines to him. I don't want him to worry. Do nothing, understand? If I ever get out of here, I swear I will. Lin clenched his fists. Your cut's open again. Little soldier grabbed the towel and handed it to Lin. Press it hard. At night, Lin lay in his bedroll, the stench of the latrine bucket overpowering. Little soldier snored. Through the tiny window high on the wall, Lin could see the clear night sky and a star. He remembered the stars of Beijing's summer nights, the scent of grapes, and the cool shade of the vines. Grandpa and he had sat on the doorstep, fanning themselves. It was too hot to sleep. Mosquitoes hung in the air in packs. Grandpa had told stories, Guan Yin and Liu Hui, the legend of the Three Kingdoms, the Monkey King and Monk Tang Seng, and the saga of the Kung Fu Knights. They are stories for boys, for you, Grandpa had said. Boys must learn faith and loyalty. For 20 years, Grandpa had watched Lin grow. There had been elementary school, fist fights, his first bicycle, his first 3 good award, football, catching dragonflies in the city moat, studying late at night. Now the doorstep was worn out, the middle bowed. Lin had left Grandpa to go to university. He had never seen the ocean, but he wanted to study oceanography. He had liked the idea of roaming the sea in its infinity. He wanted to learn more of the sea animals he had read about and seen on television and nature programs. When Lin was at high school, their neighbors, the Chen family, had bought a set, and he had gone next door to watch it whenever a nature program was showing. He had grown up with the Chen son, whom everyone called Fatty, even after he had grown into a slender young man. Go, said Grandpa, sitting cross-legged on his bed. A good son travels the 4 seas. Your mother and father would have been proud of you. Don't worry about me. I have strong bones. Besides, I have our neighbors. Nothing will happen to me. Lin wrote to his grandfather from university. He wrote about the sea that at last he had seen, shimmering under the dawn light. He told his grandfather that he had never seen anything more beautiful. The sound of the sea, Grandpa, he remembered writing, is like a song. Some hear it, some feel it. Many remember it. It was by the sea that he first saw her, like a song he couldn't forget. Her fair skin, open smile, and large brown eyes were as alluring to him as the ocean. The day she said she loved him, he was the happiest man on earth. They were walking on the beach, and Venus sparkled in the sky as if she were sending a secret message to the lovers below. The air tasted salty, and they were filled of desire and love.
Now that we're on to the Asian detective genre, I bet you're familiar with the works of John Burdett. Bangkok 8 was my first exposure to Burdett, and I've been hooked ever since on his darkly inventive fiction that always has a comic twist. In The Godfather of Kathmandu, Royal Thai Police Detective Sanjay Jitplichip is called to a grisly murder scene that could make or break his career. But he's more worried about impressing Tietzin, his new Buddhist guru. However, Tietzin would rather use Sanjay to help him broker a heroin deal worth $40 million. Left with no easy way out and plenty of moral conflict, Sanjay will have to decide between saving his soul and saving his career. This is a story combining Buddhism, morality plays, crime stories, and detective novel, all in a remarkable package tied up by the excellent narration of Stephen Hogan.
It will be interesting to see how Sukum handles my inconvenient arrival. I think I might be able to surprise him. Lek leads me past the guard's hut into the parking deck, which is also the entrance area for a 10-story apartment building that was erected in a hurry 15 years ago in order to profit on a no-frills basis from the sexual frustration of Western men over the age of 40. A fail-proof business decision. The owners got their money back in the first 3 years, and it's been honey all the way ever since. Paint is chipped and flaking from the walls, revealing white plaster with occasional graffiti. You, Farang, in Thai. Sali, you were so good last night, in English. The lift is tiny. Even the slim Lek and I find ourselves embarrassingly close for a moment. Our clash of colognes reveals our sexual orientations. He will use nothing less than Chanel number 5, which he begs from my mother, Nong. Mine is a rugged, take-no-prisoners little number from Armani. This could be one for the FBI, I say in the elevator. She's stuck in Virginia, Lek says. Poor little thing broke her arm during combat training. She was fighting 2 instructors at the same time, and of course they both came off worse. But she still can't really call herself one of the boys because she's in love with me. Don't tell her I said that.
Kimberly? Really?
She sent me an email yesterday.
Kimberly Jones, an FBI agent, is a friend of mine and Lex. Especially Lex. It's a long story. She worked with me on a few cases of an international nature and fell in love with Lek, which, awkward fact, has confused the hell out of her. Does her lust for a transsexual make her a dyke or not? I fear there is little in your culture, Farang, to provide guidance on this conundrum, so she calls me all the time. The corridor on the 4th floor leads to room 422, where 2 uniformed cops are stationed. They part to let us into the apartment, where a massive American at least 6 feet long waits propped up in semi-sitting position on a bed wearing only a gigantic pair of shorts, over the top of which a great wormy mass of intestines has flopped like tripe in a butcher's shop. His bed is so narrow that parts of his flesh sag over each side, and one has to wonder how he coped when engaged in sexual congress. The drama of this center-screen image at first makes the various slim Thai cops and forensic technicians seem like a chorus to a Greek tragedy. Then Sukum steps forward. Detective Sukum Montri is a good-looking Thai cop in his early 30s, very upright and proper when not consumed by fear, aggression, and lust, like the rest of us. But right now I discern in his eyes the fire of one who has decided that this is the moment when the fig leaf of comradeship must be dropped by both protagonists to reveal the competing stiffness of their virile members. Well, I have good news for him. Today, thanks to the way my psychosis is hanging, I'm all metas, Sanskrit for loving-kindness. However, it is important not to spoil people. I shall break the good news that I don't give a damn about promotion today, or for the rest of my life, later. For the moment, let us enjoy Sukum. He wears a black jacket, black pants, white shirt, thin pink nylon tie, pink because it's Tuesday. Our days of the week are color-coded. All items generic, i.e. not good enough to qualify as fakes. The jacket is particularly narrow at the shoulders, pinching under the arms and badly crumpled, even though I'm sure it was freshly pressed yesterday. Our gifted imitators of French and Italian haute couture would never be so crass. Sokum's tailor, if he has one, must be Thai Chinese of the old cloth-saving school.
Readers, I hope you've enjoyed today's trip around the Asian literary landscape. I know you'll agree it's the journey and not the destination that is our true reward. Be sure to journey to our website, www.bookreportradio.com, to review titles we've talked about recently. And please keep the emails coming with your suggestions by writing to me at elaine@bookreportradio.com. I'm Elaine Charles. See you next week on The Book Report. Even